Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Wikipedia. How good is it if anyone can edit it? Also, AEOB House People, Bristol group that's turning empty offices into affordable homes. Plus our weekly Private Eye News with Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with David Moat and Eleanor Kershaw. They're both from AEOB House People. Hi, both of you, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Hello,
good
hi,
to
Tony.
Be here.
Starting with you, Eleanor, why did you get involved with this group?
I'd been peripherally aware that it had started through my friendship with David for a while. But for before that, I'd been considering community housing and it got to a point of thinking, partly out of thinking, I appear to have the cat box for my street. And then you start thinking, well, actually, how many things do you need individually as a household? And how many vacuum cleaners are in use on your street all at the same time? Could you reduce how many that you need? And you, once you start thinking like that, you think, actually, what sort of facilities could we share in a much more economical and efficient way?
But I know you have an interest also in, if you're building new houses, building them in the right place.
That's right. I think there's a lot of new houses get built. People want something new. They think that that is the best way to get something efficient, is to start from scratch and build it in the best possible way. But that uses a lot of extra space. We've got massive demands on land in this country for properties. And yet we've got massive amounts of empty commercial buildings sitting there, completely empty. You'll see offices to let signs all over the city, everywhere you go. And that could be used as housing.
But you say that, but I've just been through Wiltshire today. You can drive for miles and miles and miles and not see a single house. It's just rolling green hills, mostly empty countryside.
But there's a lot of questions coming up in the news about our food security and the ability of our country to support itself in terms of farming. And if we put pressure on the countryside to build houses because people want to move further and further out of the city and have these shiny new houses, then that reduces our ability to be a self-supporting country in the long run from other perspectives.
But isn't the fact of the matter that people maybe grow up and work in the city, but then as soon as they can afford it, they buy a place in the country?
Yeah, that's because the city as it stands is not a nice place for them to live. So that's what should be dealt with. Not say, let's move out. Let's say, let's fix the city. Let's make it somewhere we want to live alongside where we work, so that we're not having to do this massive, horrible commute every day to where we work and then live somewhere else because it's nice. We should be able to work and live somewhere nice, close together.
Yeah, and I anecdotally, driving around the city, walking around the city, cycling around the city, you see so many, it seems, plots of rubble, you know, with the signboards up outside, the, you know, bits of boarding up around them. Temple Way, for example, two perfectly good buildings were demolished there within the last few years. And also lots and lots of empty buildings. So have you any idea how much of the land in Bristol, in, you know, within the city, is could be being used but isn't, either empty or just flattened and demolished land?
I think we're getting towards, there was around, probably one, almost getting on for 2 million sort of square feet of empty office buildings, and that's not including the new ones which are they're trying to sell off plan, like the one you mentioned down Temple Way, the glass, whatever it's called, Glass Wharf.
Yeah.
Which it's, they've got big signs up there saying it's BREEAM certificated, so it's one of the best sort of top spec for environmental attributes, but you turn around from looking at that site, literally turn on your feet in the same place, and you'll see almost every other building on that roundabout has got a significant proportion of it empty.
I know, they're quite sneaky, aren't they? I've noticed quite often if there's only one tenant, they'll put them on the ground floor. So if you're just walking past, you don't notice that the rest of the office block is empty. Also, David, what brought you into AEOB House People? It's not the easiest, it doesn't trip off the tongue the easiest, but it stands for...
abolish empty office buildings, house people.
Well, it sounds like a great concept, but how are you going to abolish empty office buildings?
By demonstrating that ordinary people can get together and create a model housing cooperative out of an office building, reusing it for residential purposes.
Why are you focused on office buildings then?
I suppose office buildings are noticeable, are iconic, and because in our kind of economy, offices seem to get built when other places are at a standstill. It is extraordinary that we've had this massive recession, but the developers seem to be able to sit on their assets for years and years, or even build new places where ordinary people can't afford somewhere to live. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring together people with money and good intent, and people with need and with skills without the financial means to be able to bring their own dreams to fruition.
Well, now something seems to be very wrong, because if it was me owning an office building, I wouldn't be able to afford to keep it empty for maybe 10 years. I'd have to have people in there. So how is it that we've got all these office buildings in the city, those that haven't been demolished, that are empty?
We've asked this question ourselves as a group, and one of us has been researching it. Well, I haven't seen the results of that research yet, but it's something to do with tax breaks. It's something to do with being able to sit on assets. I think there's a phrase used, it's land banking.
Right.
You sit on these assets, and they are assets. In the same, you and I might have money in the bank. It's the bank kept in the form of a building. And what's wrong about it is that it doesn't put people first. It doesn't give value to the lives of people who need somewhere to live. It's not based on need. It's based on power, on an asset that at some point, I suppose it's collateral, you know, at some point it can be converted into...
Well, it's just like money in the bank, isn't it? And the other thing, I suppose, is that if it's empty, you can sell it at the drop of a hat. You've got, you know, it's vacant possession. If someone's going to buy an office building off you, they don't really want to have to deal with lots and lots of tenants inside it and renegotiate tenancy agreements or whatever with them. If you're going to buy a building, you want it empty, don't you?
Yeah. So what... You asked me earlier on how this happened. I was running something called a Reconciliation Laboratory, and it was focused on the divisions in Bristol between rich and poor. And one of the biggest markers is who owns a house and who doesn't. If you're in the property market, I mean, I am, for example. I 20-something years ago, I was able to buy my house for $39,500, and it's now paid off. I'm one of the fortunate ones. So without much effort, I'm able to live well on very little.
So are you looking to buy somewhere bigger and expand?
No, or? I'm not at all. I'm content with what I've got. But I think it's completely wrong that other people who are really struggling with very high rents in much poorer quality housing than it, I think that's a scandal.
Well, maybe, Eleanor, you can tell us about paying rent, because this seems to be... I mean, what's happened here is David, because he's managed to get on the property ladder early, he's used his, essentially paying off his mortgage or whatever, his rent, to get himself a place at the end of it. But for many people, that's just simply not possible.
Yeah.
Generation rent, I think they call it.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm 30, and I've really feel like I've seen from the very beginning of my renting days the point where I am not expecting to be able to buy a property. The first house that I lived in was a tiny little sort of back-to-back pokey kind of place, but it was perfect for what we needed at the time. And the house next door to us, when I first moved in there, was on the market for about 18,000. And this was up in West Yorkshire. And by the time I left there, about 18 months later, a house down the end of the street, exactly the same model, pretty much the same sort of internal condition, went for 31,000. So that had nearly doubled in a year and a half. And then I look at the equivalent kind of places around here, and you're looking at nearly 100,000 just for a two-bedroom flat.
Now, it was one of the Conservative councillors in Cirencester last week was reported as saying, well, 250,000 to 300,000, that's affordable housing.
Well, think about the amount of mortgage that you'd have just to be able to buy that when you can only get four times your income to... that's crazy. It's an absolutely crazy amount of money for anyone to try and get hold of, unless they're lucky enough to have very rich family who can support them.
So, I mean, you've been paying rent for a good while. Yeah. You've been thinking about this. What do you think's wrong with the system that's allowed somebody like you to be paying really over the odds for rent for such a long time and still end up at the end of it with nothing?
It's because everybody is out there to make money. Landlords can charge what they want with no real requirement to make sure it's in good condition, and the rental level is basically seems to be based on what they can sell you. So it's
what they can get away with.
Exactly, it's two bedrooms, therefore it must be at least this much. We have the local housing allowance, which is supposed to support people on low incomes. My house is already at, when I first moved in, it was bang on the local housing allowance. After 2 years of living there, I'm now having to find an extra £50 a month out of thin air to be able to continue living there. But my option is live there or live nowhere, because there isn't anywhere else to go to. I can't turn around and say, well, that's all right, I can move to somewhere that's back within my budget, because it just isn't there. And unless you have a massive list of severe impediments to getting a normal house, there's no point in applying to be on the housing register.
Well, I can see why you're part of the residents group for AEOB House People. We'll give them another plug. But tell us, how does the residents group work?
We've got a collection of people from various different backgrounds. Some, like myself, someone who's currently has been living in a van for a while, quite happy living in a van, but would actually like sort of a one-bedroom place in the community. We've got people who various different situations, but all who feel they have a lack of secure housing, whether that's because they're self-employed, so they can't maintain a higher rent, or they might need to be able to step back to a lower rent at a later point in time. But what we try and do is use it to explore, rather than just saying, right, you know, we'll write you down on the list and when we get our property, you go in. It's not like that. We use these people's experience. We share our experiences to try and work out what are people's needs, to try and tease out the difference between our needs and our wants, and what do we really need individually if we think about it, rather than saying, well, this is that we all want to subscribe to this sort of social conditioning idea of what we're supposed to want in a house, which for a lot of people just really isn't true.
Well, that's a lovely opportunity if you can to get involved in designing your own place. But what about living on top of people? People don't always get on, do they?
The problem is there are lots of places where you do live on top of each other, high-rise flats or even just sort of apartment blocks, and often they don't work because you're not neighbours. You are fighting with each other. It's always about conflict. It's about who's leaving stuff in the stairwell and things like that. But if you imagine just a block of eight, say maisonettes, in that situation, who share a stairwell, if instead of saying of those people fighting over whose responsibility it was to do this, that and the other, or who was leaving things around, those people are actually part of a community. They were their own tenants' organisation, their own community cooperative. They have regular meetings that say, and they which they all agree to, these are things you can put in this place. This is our shared space.
My point is that you don't always agree at the meeting. You know, no. People just don't necessarily always get on, do they?
No, they don't.
And for a lot of people, they're thinking, well, you know, do I really want to be part? I'd rather just have my own place and not have to make agreements with neighbours and that sort of thing.
But conflict is part of what makes we need face to face conflict to work through conflict to build community.
Yeah, but for a lot of people, for example, if they've shared a house, conflict is why they don't want to do it anymore.
But if you can sit down over a cup of coffee and have a half hour shout out about what it is that's causing the problem, so everyone understands what's going on, you're much more likely to come to a resolution than you are bickering and bitching at each other, but back and forth at the door every time you happen to see each other, because you've got a forum to air your grievances. And you've got other people there who are part of your community who also have a vested interest in the success of it to help you mediate. People have a lot of skills that they don't necessarily realise they have. People find that they are natural mediators and facilitators when it comes to getting people to see each other's point of view, to work towards a common goal.
There are a lot of damaged people out there, aren't there, on the housing ladder? They're not always very easy people to reason with.
Yeah, that's true. And one of the things we've identified is as a community building need, as part of what we want to do, is to give access to skills for people who are maybe coming into the cooperative who have no background in it, or for the group in general, that if we and they feel it would be beneficial to, for example, run a workshop to help people. There are other people, yes, there are examples of housing communities which haven't worked, but there are also examples of housing communities that have, that really have and really thrived, and we can learn from them. Conversely, we're moving forward, if we can get it to really work here, we want to share what we've learnt to let other people do it again somewhere else. And we'd be we're working towards putting together sort of materials and potentially sort of workshops. We'd be happy to go and say, well, yeah, this is how we did it. Here's some ideas to help people get started elsewhere.
No, this is not all hot air, because you've got over £100,000 committed to and you've put an offer on a building.
We've actually got virtually £200,000 in the bank. This is through a community share offer, because our idea is that there are people with money out there who can be part of the solution, who feel a concern. Take me as an example. You know, I've bought a few shares, about £3,000 worth of shares in this, and I think it's a good thing. I think there are creative people with a bit of money out there who can meet midway people with need, but with the skills to do a bit of building work, to create community, to do other things.
Well, they say safe as houses. I hope your money is safe as houses. Do you think it is safe?
Well, I think so. Nothing in life is completely risk free.
No, Northern Rock tells us that, doesn't
it? Yes, I mean, I had an endowment mortgage. The whole endowment scheme was oversold. We've had protection, you know, for card protection,
payment protection insurance
that was oversold. I had a Equitable Life. I was persuaded by my family to put money in Equitable Life, you know, pension, and that was mismanaged. Cooperative Bank. Now, there's no safety out there, but I choose to put my money in something I believe in, that is a registered cooperative, that is managed by people I respect, that I can see face to face, that is going to be put to good use. And through many dozens of people, we've raised 200,000. We need 100,000 more to complete on the purchase of a place which we've identified. I won't reveal where it is, you know, because someone else could come in there and snatch it off us. But we've had an offer accepted on a place that is or has been very recently an office building that is very suitable for conversion to a residence.
But David, people also want a return on their money, don't they? On their investment, they expect a little bit back in interest from the bank.
Yes, we're not running a charitable model. We're offering 3% return on the investment, and in a 30-year period, which is the financial model we've drawn up, we've shown a break-even situation with that 3% return.
Look, come on, let's talk about the Wonga. How much do you get back for your investment?
3% on what you've invested.
Okay. Eleanor, give us a reason why people should put a bit of money into this.
We talked about investment. Lots of people invest in different ways. People who've got money, they don't want it to just sit there. And there's a difference between going down to the bank and saying, I want an investment. And the people who are taking that money off you, they're interested in making profit from themselves.
Maybe
making profit for you, but not. They're not necessarily, it doesn't bother them. If
the highest
fails.
Profits come from drug dealing and arms dealing, don't they? And whilst HSBC actually were dealing with the money launderers and drug cartels in Mexico.
Yeah. Mm.
So I'm hoping that you're going to guarantee you're not using the money to invest in those kind of things.
Well, we're currently registered as a cooperative. We're going to be moving to a community benefit society. But again, it's registered, uses the same cooperative rules. They're regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, and the community share offer is recognised and regulated by them. So we have to have, in order to be that organisation, we have to have a very strict set of rules by which we run the society, which are publicly available, and we are accountable entirely to our members.
So if people are convinced they're interested in investing a little bit in your concern, getting some of these old office buildings converted to people to live in, where can they go? How can they do it?
We have a website which is www.aeobhousepeople.org.uk. On there, you'll see all the information, the details and statistics that back up what we've been talking about today, and opportunities to invest. There's also links to guidance, independent guidance on investing in community shares from the cooperatives, UK organisations. So we don't want anyone to jump into it just because we've said it's great. We want people to do it in an informed and sensible way.
And what about if people are looking for somewhere to live as well? Because, I mean, we've got something like 15,000 out there in Bristol on their housing.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got the... On the website there, there's the prospective residents group. I'm the key contact for the prospective residents, and we currently meet about every 4 weeks. So anyone who wants to get in touch, who wants to know more about what we're doing, I'd be more than happy to talk to them about that.
Fantastic. Well, Eleanor Kershaw and David Merritt, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Hello, it's Elia Pablo in our weekly tech roundup. With me there is Erlanda. Hello.
Hi, Elia.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good. Today we're going to talk about popular movements that are fighting against the NSA and the GCHQ mass surveillance. They have great ideas that we want to introduce, but first I would like our audience to hear this audio from Reset the Net.
We use the internet to be ourselves, but governments are building a prison around it. We have to stop them, but how? They seem so vast and powerful. But government spies have a weakness. They can hack anybody, but they can't hack everybody. Folks like the NSA depend on collecting insecure data from tapped fiber. They depend on our mistakes. Mistakes we can fix. The plan? Reset the net. Together, on June 5th, 1 year after Snowden's first NSA story, we all take one powerful step to turn off government spying and turn on freedom. The call is simple. Find some territory of the internet that you can protect from prying eyes. Seize it and hold it. Are you a developer? Promise to add one NSA-resistant feature to your app. Are you an internet user? Promise to try one NSA-resistant privacy tool. Got a website or Tumblr? Run our splash screen on June 5th to show the world we're resetting the net.
Well, for more information, you can go to YouTube, you can see the video there, or you can go to resetthenet.org, and they explain what they want to do. But Ed, would you like to light us?
So I like the idea of this. It's a grassroots movement where people are trying to think of just small things they can do to reclaim our privacy. And a lot of things they're attempting, you could argue that the NSA are just going to work around straight away. But you can put forward the argument that just purely by making it harder for them, you're creating more work for them. They have a finite amount of resources, even if they try and recruit more people. If you've got everyone around the world just trying to do, as I said, small things like making apps on smartphones more secure, maybe starting to use encryption on their emails. Some of these technologies have already been broken by the NSA, but that's not to say that we can't make their life a little bit more difficult. So I think it's a really good thing to see that people are starting to wake up, switch on, and as I say, start an awareness campaign.
I think it's very important that people get aware, which I think that it's what they want to do. They were talking about doing this splash screen. Do you know what it's about?
I think it's the idea that for one day of the year, you confront people with this issue. And if they go to some websites, hopefully popular websites, not just smaller websites, they are greeted with this banner to tell them about Reset the Net and to just educate them, you know, and instead of people just doing their online shopping or looking at their news or reading emails or something, just confront them and say, look, hey, did you know that you're being surveilled, and did you know that these are some small things we can do? I think it's a good idea. How about you?
It seems like a very good idea because everyone like start knowing that this is happening. But do you think like the big companies like Google, Apple, they are gonna jump on this? Because it would be very, very useful.
That's a really interesting question. I can't see it happening with Reset the Net this year, but my understanding is that all these tech giants are pretty put out by these leaks because they've been, you know, shown to be co-opted by the government, and it seems like they didn't want to be. You know, it's easy to demonize these companies, but it seems like they've been strong-armed into this, and now they realize it's hurting their business, and ultimately their businesses, their shareholders' interests are for them to maximize their profits. And if people all around the world, particularly in Europe, Russia, and China, and Asia, stop using American corporation services, particularly communication services, because of the privacy issues, and that's a huge crisis for not just the tech giants in America, but the American economy. And they're going to have to act, because ultimately money makes the world go round.
It's a good thing that for once the big giants are not together with the government. It's different. I heard that there is also another movement that is getting strong, but I think you would like to talk about this.
Yeah, this is a really nice idea. It's the grassroots movement again. Somebody's identified that the NSA supercomputers, or the farms that they have in the States, require huge amounts of water to cool all these computers, and they're pushing for an idea to shut off the water. Basically, to, you know, that's one way of shutting down this surveillance operation overnight, if you take down the water. And you know, as unrealistic as that may sound, I just think it's just a wonderful idea.
How are they going to do that?
That's a good question. So they'll be lobbying the local municipalities, trying to get local leaders to take action, and obviously there will be immense pressure that you probably never ever witnessed, that would make Occupy Wall Street look like a standard May Day protest, that will just reveal the strings attached to the NSA, and that will out the power of the NSA in the same way that the police brutality in Manhattan outed the power of the banks. This is just another way to expose power, to shine a light on power, and who knows what may come from that. You know, you never know how people are going to react to seeing violent repression of protest and direct action.
Yeah, and it seems like everyone agrees that the government is not actually going to do anything. But now I would like to talk about Wikipedia, which it's been allegations that government computers have been editing some pages. What do you know about this?
So this is a strange one. When I first heard about it, my instinctive reaction was to expect it to be something very cynical and something akin to a conspiracy theory, where the government was going around changing Wikipedia pages and removing very interesting controversial content. But it seems more like vandalism, and it seems to be committed by individuals employed by the government who, for some reason or another, felt like they wanted to troll Wikipedia and put some offensive statements. As far as I can tell, doesn't appear to be, I said, anything other than an individual malicious intent, but it does give you an insight into what kind of environment you have in Whitehall and in the civil service, and what kind of people work there, and what they think they can get away with. And you could argue that's the same in any corporation or any government body, but it's very embarrassing for the government, certainly. And it's the usual thing. It only came out through a very targeted and clever freedom of information request. So we must be all very grateful for the people who've unearthed this really quite distasteful behavior.
Well, we have Tony Goslin, who have been speaking with Stevie Benton, which is the head of external relations of Wikipedia UK.
My name is Stevie Benton. I'm from Wikimedia UK, where I'm the head of external relations. Wikimedia UK is the UK charity that supports and promotes Wikipedia and other Wikimedia projects such as Wikimedia Commons and Wikiversity.
Because I've seen Wikipedia a lot, you know, in fact, a lot of journalists will use it to get some basic bits of information on a subject that maybe isn't quite so biased as some they've seen elsewhere. But how reliable is Wikipedia?
There have been lots of studies into the reliability of Wikipedia, and it obviously depends on which articles you're looking at. However, the reliability of Wikipedia tends to stand up pretty favourably when compared to, say, Encyclopedia Britannica.
Wow, that's not bad. But I mean, we had a news story a few years ago about Bell Pottinger, a massive lobbying company that were being paid to change pages on Wikipedia.
I think there's a general rule of thumb that our editing community tends to pick up on what we call paid advocacy editing pretty quickly. So particularly in high-profile companies or high-profile individuals, their pages are more likely to be quite closely watched by the editing community of volunteers, of which there are around 70,000 or so very active volunteers.
Those volunteers, how do they organise amongst themselves? I mean, do you find that some people who've been doing it for years are more active?
Yes, length of involvement with Wikipedia isn't always a good indicator of how active people are. But what you may not see is that behind the scenes, there are lots of what we call project pages and administrative pages where users can discuss articles or discuss specific parts of articles. And each article also has a talk page in which users and editors can make suggestions for content and highlight potential problems with content. So there's a very active community. These articles don't just grow in isolation. There is an administrative infrastructure that supports the creation of content.
But how do you tell if someone is trying to edit a Wikipedia page with one particular axe to grind?
That's often quite apparent through editing patterns and the way that certain content is edited. So one of the pillars of Wikipedia is a neutral point of view. It's pretty easy to tell, if you know what you're looking for, to see when something is written in a way that supports or promotes a particular viewpoint.
How do you determine whether something, bit of information on Wikipedia is reliable?
Wikipedia information has to be verified. So you would check a reference, particularly if there's a claim that you aren't sure is true, or you think may seem a little bit dubious. You would click the reference, have a look at the information that's cited there, and see if that's reflective of the content of the article.
And how does it work when two people have just got opposing views and they're both trying to edit the same page? What happens then?
To begin with, there would be... It may look as though there's an edit war of some, say I make a change and you don't like it, you change it back, that might happen. And then what would initially happen after that is that you would have a discussion on the talk page, perhaps, or you may ask an uninvolved administrator of Wikipedia, again, a volunteer administrator, to have a look and to assess the content.
Okay, so someone else, a sort of referee, to come in and decide.
Yeah, you could call it a referee, you could call it a mediator, whatever. It's a volunteer who would do that.
And ultimately, what's the purpose of Wikipedia? I mean, you said right at the start it's better than Encyclopedia Britannica. How do you justify that, and what evidence have you got for that?
There are plenty of studies that you can find that will have a look at the accuracy of Wikipedia compared to that of Encyclopedia Britannica. The aim of Wikipedia and the other Wikimedia projects, such as Wikimedia Commons, is to share the sum total of all human knowledge with everyone on the planet for free. That's what we're working to do, and there's still a long way to go, but I think we make a pretty good stab at it.
So why haven't Encyclopedia Britannica and other big organisations in the past been able to do this? Have they all come from a particular point of view? Do you think the editors, the owners maybe, have had an influence on the way the content's opened up over the years?
I don't know. I couldn't really comment on the way that other websites run or other encyclopedias manage their content. What makes Wikipedia special is anyone can contribute, and there's this enormous community of volunteer contributors and editors that over time have created this wonderful resource that's free for everybody to use.
Now, I know a couple of years ago I was trying to use Wikipedia one day and it said, no, Wikipedia is not here today. It was a kind of protest. What was that about?
So that was a protest against two pieces of legislation in the United States called SOPA and PIPA. They were essentially looking to restrict the way that content can be published online and the sharing of content online and the use of links and resources and various information from various sources. The community of editors decided that they didn't like this piece of legislation and that it was a serious threat to Wikipedia. Therefore, they took a community decision after lots of discussion to turn Wikipedia dark for a day.
And how do you see the future of the internet as someone that spends quite a lot of time on it?
The future of the internet really does depend on many things. I'm not really an internet expert, but it depends on the way that governments continue to use the internet, how they intend to use it for surveillance purposes and monitoring purposes, whether we end up with, say, a internet rights charter for web users. There are lots of ways it could go, and I wouldn't really want to hazard a guess.
What about privatisation? Because I know quite a lot of the internet is privately owned. part of, obviously a lot of the channels that information runs along are privately owned, and sometimes private owners start charging more than people can afford, don't they?
Wikipedia is free. It'll always be free. We don't accept advertising. We don't have a commercial interest. Our interest is solely to facilitate the sharing of knowledge for free with everybody.
So, Ed, what do you think about this interview?
Well, it's clear that as a representative of Wikimedia, he has to be very careful with what he says. But it's good to hear that Wikipedia stacks up nicely along with encyclopedias. I mean, it's popular for people to slate Wikipedia for being inaccurate, and I think that's, in my opinion, I don't necessarily agree that it's inaccurate, and I think it's almost been deliberately disseminated to try and discredit it, because we live in the age of information, and it's information that's power, and I feel empowered by Wikipedia. There are things on Wikipedia I'd never know about otherwise. You know, you can be watching a film, listening to a radio show, reading a book, anything, and in this on-demand world where you can just pause things, you can go and research, and you never know where you end up because there's hyperlinks everywhere. So you click around and you read all kinds of interesting stuff. And I think that, yeah, it's very important that Wikipedia continues to do what it does, tries to stay as impartial and accurate as it does, and as I say, just give everyone access to as much information as they can get.
It seems it's quite a popular social service, like everyone can say what they think, but they will always check if it's true, if the references are all right, if it seems quite secure. All the opposite, as you said, all the opposite that it's been said. But at the same time, it's who is behind what it say? Who says this is all right to say? This information may not be all right to be in the net.
Yeah, I've seen some suspicious edits. Well, not the edits themselves, but I've seen some suspicious text where it looks like somebody has gone out to sabotage a particular article. And unfortunately, I don't really know what to do about that, because I don't want to go and edit the text directly in case, you know, there is a legacy there. There was an editing war there and it's come out correctly. It's just my intuition. And looking at the talk pages that were mentioned in that interview, again, it's not clear if anyone's going to read that or anything. So it, as far as going to correct incorrect information, I don't feel empowered to do that. But at least people can judge for themselves, you know, read every article carefully and engage their brain.
Well, thank you very much for the chat of this week. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Jason Yannakopoulos is joining me. Tony Gosling here again. Thanks very much to Ed and Elia for that. We've got Private Eye, haven't we? Jason, what's in it this week?
Indeed. Wow. An £18.6 million fine for fund manager Invesco Perpetual this week could prove embarrassing for new Treasury Minister Andrea Leadsom.
Okay, so she's a Treasury Minister. The idea is that they're trying to get more women into the Cabinet because they keep sacking them. And they said right at the very start of the Parliament that the coalition government was going to have more women than ever before. But they keep sacking them for whatever reason. I'm sure it's not that they're being bullied out. I mean, that would be impossible, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, it says here the Financial Conduct Authority found that from May 2008, the firm repeatedly broke rules limiting risk for investors and failed to disclose the use of derivatives that multiply the task.
Okay, so which firm is this again?
This is Invesco Perpetual. It's rather unfortunate, being as the person overseeing Invesco at the time was new Treasury Minister Andrea Leadsom.
Oh dear. So is she competent to do the job?
Well, you really have to ask that, don't you?
Okay, so also Lord Paton we've heard about, haven't we, this week. He's resigning as the chairman of the BBC. I just think that the idea of appointing a former Bath MP who was the chairman of the Conservative Party, who was kicked out by the public in a general election, to be chairman of the BBC was always going to be a bad idea. If the public has completely rejected somebody and when they're supposed to be in their prime, you know, in a very important post in government, I think it was 1993, and the public have said no, but somebody has decided to put him in charge of the BBC. The other thing about
the best idea.
About Chris Patton was that, well, is that he has big investments in this company called Bridgepoint, or connections anyway, financial connections with this company called Bridgepoint, which is a private healthcare provider, very, very interested in the end of the National Health Service. So I wonder whether maybe we'll see more documentaries now Chris Patton has gone into the destruction of the NHS, Jason.
Well, quite possibly. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that the number of Tory ministers and former Tory ministers who would benefit from the privatisation of the NHS.
It's extraordinary. And let's remember, of course, that David Cameron didn't say that he wouldn't put a tank next to the NHS and blow it to smithereens, did he? What he did say was there'll be no top-down organisation, but he didn't say it wouldn't be smashed to smithereens, as I remember in the 2010 election. What are your thoughts about what's happening to the health service anyway? I mean, how, have you had much to do with it, and have you noticed many changes, Jason?
Well, I haven't had too much to do with it personally, although my mother is about to go in for a hip operation.
Because I was talking to Alison Pollock the other day, Allysonpollock. She's the author of a book called NHS PLC, and she's absolutely adamant that what's happening in Britain is there's an exact copying of the US system is what is being brought in here. And the point she makes is that the US system is at least twice as expensive as the British system. So the NHS is actually a very efficient way of delivering healthcare. In the United States, lots of people, because of private profit, get all sorts of treatment and medicines that they don't necessarily need, and they're paying through the nose for it. So that's what we're heading for here, I'm afraid, if nothing is done. And there are some campaign groups around to stop the privatisation of the NHS, such as Save Our NHS, and quite a few groups in Bristol. So just a little reminder that we're losing something right now, which is one of the most important things that Britain has ever managed to share with the world, and makes us, you know, we can be proud to be British, because the National Health Service was one of the greatest things that humanity has ever managed to achieve. Oh. And it's being smashed apart by the coalition.
Oh, quite.
Anyway, yeah, Alison Pollock, you can follow her on Twitter or etc. Or just, you know, she's just an amazing, amazing woman. I was incredibly privileged to meet her the other week. So, okay. Back down to earth, back down to private eye. Well, I'm my own little private eye for a minute there. Cyril Smith, this is this rather large Liberal MP from the 1970s and early 80s. What have you got? Found out about him?
This one's quite interesting. It's actually a quote from somebody who's still alive and facing a bit of an issue on that sort of front, Lord Renard.
Oh, that's right. This is the disgraced...
The disgraced Liberal Democrat peer, Lord Renard. It raised the point that in 2010, he says that one of his biggest personal inspirations was Cyril Smith.
Oh, no. And he was the idea really was that he was just denying that he was groping women, Lord Renard. But most people who you speak to seem to think that the women wouldn't all just made it up. Anyway, bankers' bonuses. This is always a regular slot on here. The bankers' bonuses, don't tell me, the bankers' bonuses are going to be cut for a change.
Sadly not.
Oh.
So, yes. The row over bonuses at Royal Bank of Scotland posed the question, what's the point of UK financial investments, the arm's length government body that represents interest as a shareholder in bailed out banks? Given the outcry that...
Sorry, that is an organisation again, Jason, because they're quite important people. Like, these are the reason that these bailed out banks, the RBS and NatWest and Lloyds, are all actually owned by us and owned by the Treasury. And so there is an organisation that's supposed to be representing the public's interest in these banks and making them work properly and serve the public. So what is that organisation called again?
That's UK Financial Investments. And given the outcry that bosses at loss-making RBS would have caused, Chancellor George Osborne's decision to overrule the UK Financial Investments decision to vote in favour of 200% payouts . It's not surprising.
Okay, so basically what's happening
is... And apparently 100% will still be okay.
So they're saying we don't think that the nationalised banks should be being paid as much as the privatised banks, and that they we should rein back these bonuses paid with public money to the bankers at RBS, etc. And don't tell me George Osborne has come in and said, no, they should have these massive bonuses.
No, actually, this time he came against it. However,
oh, hooray!
But why was the UK Financial Investments, this arm's-length government body that represents the public interest, happy with the tripling of the shares in the first place? Well, certainly because, as has been pointed out many times, particularly by the private eye, it is staffed by investment bankers, including its new chief executive, former Credit Suisse London boss, James Lee Pemberton, and board members from UBS, Citigroup, and Merrill Lynch. Osborne deftly spun the RBS mess up into his own clamping down on bankers' bonuses, overshadowing the news that the UK Financial Investments will still be able to vote on the public's behalf for the 200% bonuses at the 25% state-owned Lloyds Banking Group.
So, oh, no, so that's Lloyds. Oh, OK. Yeah. So how come that Osborne has been able to overrule the RBS bonuses but not the Lloyds bonuses?
It doesn't say that. It
doesn't explain it. Well, that's so frustrating, isn't it? Surely if these people are there to represent us, then can't they take those 200 million of bonuses and spend those on the people in this country that really need it?
Well, one would hope that they would do that, yes.
But they can't, because they just can't. I mean, it just seems that there's something definitely very, very wrong going on. Incidentally, spinning back to a couple of minutes to the story about Lord Paton, it's just occurred to me, because he was a former Conservative Party chairman, are we now going to have a chairman of the Labour Party, or possibly an ex-Labour Prime Minister, taking over the BBC?
Would this be referring to Blair by any chance?
Tony Blair, chairman of the BBC.
Oh, oh, let's hope not, seriously.
Oh, dear, I hope not, oh dear. And we won't be having any documentaries made by Panorama about his war crimes then, will we?
No, sadly not.
If you've ever seen the TV, it was, well, cyberpunk drama called Max Headroom, that is the sort of thing that happens on the Max Headroom drama to his reporter, is he's investigating a story and he realises it leads right to the door of his chairman, and there is his chairman up to no good, and he's filming him live on the TV, you know. So that would be the kind of thing, is if Panorama was started to investigate, maybe Panorama now can do an investigation into their former chairman Chris Patton's interests in private healthcare firms.
Well, maybe.
Anyway, sorry, I'm waffling on again. What about the Saudis, Saudi Arabia?
This is an interesting one. Five conservative MPs chose an odd way to make a stand against Islamic radicalism by accepting an all-expenses-paid trip to Saudi Arabia funded by the Saudi Arabian government themselves.
Wouldn't you, Jason? If someone said to you, an all-expenses-paid... Really?
No.
All-expenses-paid? Come on, to one of the hottest countries on earth?
No. The five MPs listed, who are David Amis of Southend, Daniel Kavinsky of Shrewsbury, Philip Davis of Shipley, David Morris of Morecambe, and Heather Weed of South Derbyshire, went on the four-day jaunt in February at a cost of £5,000 each, describing themselves as in the MPs register as an all-party parliamentary delegation. Notice that they are all Conservative MPs, so very all-party there. To meet the Shura Council, to meet the Deputy Speaker and other government ministers. Those, by the way, were all in inverted commas.
Okay, so did they manage to meet the two princesses that have been locked up in the palace in Riyadh for the last 10 years?
No, apparently not.
Ah.
These officials, like the entire Shura Council, are unelected appointees in a country where political parties are banned. But no matter, the MPs were also there. They said to visit King Saud University to discuss collaboration with UK universities on de-radicalisation. King Saud University is itself entirely sex-segregated. In February, a female student died of a heart attack after male paramedics were not allowed to enter the building for hours, according to her parents.
So this delegation, I would imagine it's there's because of all of the human rights abuses that you've just been running through some of them there, Jason, that the British government is thinking of bombing Saudi Arabia and taking it over and a regime change. Is that right?
Apparently not, because as it says at the bottom here, perhaps the magnetic qualities of Saudi oil money explain why British MPs give this give this country their time.
So there's not going to be any regime change there soon?
Sadly not.
Okay, all right. Press regulation. This, I suppose, may have something to do with the Leveson inquiry. Does it, or is that just my imagination? Because that was supposed to regulate the press, wasn't it?
Interesting. It thought it efforts to step up its own invigilator moving forward with the creation of the Regulatory Funding Company, which will finance the independent press standards organisation, which will be the replacement for the Press Complaints Commission. The RFC has just unveiled its new board of directors, which includes such people as veteran pornographer Paul Ashford, who is the right-hand man of Richard Desmond, who is the owner of the Daily Express. Paul Vickers, the legal director of the Trinity Mirror, whose internal review into phone hacking at the Mirror decided that they were all squeaky clean. And Ellis Watson, the chief executive of DC Thompson Publishing and former marketing boss of The Sun and the News of the World.
Unbelievable. Okay. Do you think that press regulation is necessary? Have we got a good enough press in Britain, Jason?
Well, it's really hard to say.
Apart from this show, of course.
Well, this show is... Oh, yes, this show has been amazing.
But we're biased, aren't we? But no, seriously though, because you think you can wade in and try and regulate the press, and that actually starts to be censorship, doesn't it?
Yes. On the other hand, though, the press is guilty of absolute wrongdoing and quite often of not very journalistic practice, such as writing pieces that are entirely one-sided.
Yeah, well, the trouble being, of course, that the journalists don't own the newspapers, do they? The newspapers and the...
Maybe that's the people we should be looking at as the people that own the newspapers.
Well, that's right. Who are the big owners of the newspapers? Who are the big editors? You know, if only the journalists owned the printing presses and owned the transmitters, goodness me, we'd have a very, very different press in this country. Anyway, Prince Andrew... I just I was tweeting away this week, Jason, the royal family, and this is the Grand Lodge of Illinois, tweeting that King George VI was a Freemason. Well, I know Edward VII almost certainly was a Freemason, but I didn't know King George VI was. But this comes from a Masonic authority in over in the United States, in Illinois, and they're saying that there's no mention of Freemasonry in the Oscar-winning film about King George VI. He was a Freemason, and so was his therapist called Lionel.
Wow.
But Prince Andrew, well, we don't really know whether he's a Freemason or not. What's he been up to?
Well, Prince Andrew's star turned at Davos in January and was helpful royal on royal negotiations with the Bahrain's Al Khalifa family.
Well, just to mention, Davos is this elite gathering in the Swiss mountains, like some sort of Bond villains gathering, where Prince Andrew was. What was he up to there?
So he was there, and it was intended to herald his return to a new trade role following the unpleasantness with his American paedophile friend Jeffrey Epstein, which put Page's previous role as UK Special Representative back in 2011. The Duke of York was even allowed to take part in high-level trade talks during last month's Irish state visit, plans for an official announcement from Downing Street this autumn. Alas, following lurid revelations in US court documents, and subsequently the Daily Mail, from a woman who claims to have been one of Epstein's underage victims, claims to have met Prince Andrew in the company of Epstein when she was just 15. David Cameron has thought better of the idea. However, no one has actually told the Duke of York this yet.
Well, hopefully they will soon.
Yes.
Finally, Sussex University. What's been going on there? That's quite a nice place. I remember going down there back in the 1980s, early
80s. Well, I'm afraid things are not quite as rosy down there, Tony, because Big Brother has come to Sussex University. Private security guards at Sussex University will wear continuously recording video cameras as they patrol the campus and be obliged to take all reasonable steps to prevent any protests and demonstrations on the premises.
Oh, this is happening more and more in British universities. So they're saying that because it's private property, you're not allowed to protest here. Well, whatever happened to the student right to protest?
Well, I'm afraid that's being sacrificed by our coalition government, Tony.
Oh, more bad news from private eye. I love it. Give me more next week, Jason.
I certainly will. Thank you, Tony.
All the best. Thanks. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download this podcast from dialectradio.co.uk or this and many others from Radio 4 All. That's radio4.org. and from bcfmradio.com/dialect. Thanks to our guests, Eleanor Kershaw and David Moat from AEOB House People. Also to Elia Pablo, Ed Lander, and you just heard Jason Yannakopoulos. Also studio engineer Dave Bozanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
It's very cleansing for the soul to have no passion at all.